Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 12th of June. A delight to have you with us on this Wednesday. A lot going on, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We'll talk to you about all of that. We have a great panel, as always. Let me introduce them to you, and then we'll get started. We welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Jen Smith is with us, Berkshire Eagle reporter extraordinaire, our Wednesday regular, and it's great to have you here. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Joe.
Always good to have you here. The Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Glad to be here. Special shout out to Murray. I heard about Murray last week during the wonderful fun drive, and I just want to say hello to Alan's puppy today.
My 12-year-old puppy, Murray.
Murray did it.
Yep.
Always good to have Murray in the house. Tetherless World Professor of Computer,
Tetherless,
Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, also Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Henler. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning.
Good to have you.
Hey, you know, so this is my first time since this fun drive, and I got to tell you, what I really found gratifying was listening to the number of people who listed Roundtable among their top choices. Some of them even mentioned the panel.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, it's those stats are undeniable. It's an extraordinary number of people who listen to this program, and we can tell because we have, you know, data. And so there it is.
And we thank you all for being a part of it. Absolutely. WAMC's Alan Chartok at the head of the roundtable. Good morning, sir. How are you?
That's very flattering of you. Joe, I'm a little tired. Last night, you know, my regular bedtime is about 7:30 because I get up around 2:30. But I went to honor the great Ann Erickson, our board member who is retiring from the Empire Justice Center, the leader of that group. And what a turnout it was, and what a wonderful evening. But I got to sleep about 3 hours later than usual, so you can hear it this morning.
Hear it a little bit.
Yeah.
But the jubilance of celebrating Ann Erickson will wake us all up.
Absolutely right.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Let's get started. We have a lot to talk about, and we will get going. And so I was going to go with politics first, but I think because I wanted to talk about Biden and Trump, because that is a great story. But I do want to talk about what happened overnight, and that is Hong Kong. Tens of thousands of demonstrators stormed the streets in protest of a bill that would allow extraditions to China. Hong Kong police are firing tear gas as protesters bear down on the legislature. This story that I am reading for the Washington Post was just updated about a half hour ago. It was the second time in 5 years that Hong Kong's main roads have been occupied in defiance of Beijing's tightening control on a semi-autonomous city. Hong Kong's Harcourt Road, a major thoroughfare tying the city together, was the scene of massive street battles between the young protesters and police throughout the afternoon until the rally was dispersed by evening. Though the tens of thousands of protesters were eventually driven off, they did apparently force president of the legislature to postpone the scheduled second reading of the controversial bill in the legislature. We did touch on the story on Monday, but obviously that is escalating as the days goes on.
Well, it's for the protesters, it's definitely something worth fighting for. It's something that's been, you know, maintaining that separation, maintaining those differences in society. You know, they value those differences, and they don't want to, you know, come under Beijing rule, especially when it has to do with legalities and things like extradition and being juried.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons for us in the United States is this is what happens when people don't trust the justice system, or when they think that that the justice system is not fair and it's not justice for all. I'm waiting to see comments coming from the administration. I mean, right now, I sort of feel it shows part of the weakness of our moral authority across the world, that we should be coming out supporting, as a nation, we should be coming out supporting the right of the folks in Hong Kong to preserve their and protect their civil liberties.
Yeah, and I think it's worth just talking about a little bit of the impact on Hong Kong, because, you know, sort of if you're not really following the differences between China and sort of the rest of Southeast Asia, and Hong Kong is sort of caught in the middle. So first of all, you have business impacts, right? So Hong Kong has really been a business center for a lot of international business. What they're worried about is the extradition of businessmen. So you have the Canadian businessman because of the Huawei story who's now been, you know, indicted in China, right? So now we're worried about you have U.S. or other foreign people who are using Hong Kong as a base suddenly can be pulled into the Chinese justice system, where, as you say, there are these questions. But the other thing I think that's scary to the Hong Kong folks, and I have some friends at University of Hong Kong and some of the others, is that so China has moved to a system where they're using an awful lot of technology, what we would call invasive technologies, AI technologies and things like that, to judge what they call social credit. So basically, you get a social credit score, and whether you can get a job, whether you can move up in society, things like that are based on your social credit, which includes things like, I mean, it's literally to the point of if you're not getting enough steps on your Fitbit, yep, that will count against your social, very Black Mirror, and real. And, you know, some of the technologies they're using and things like that are, you know, frankly scary, and stuff our government is talking a lot about at the border now. So it's easy for these things to creep around. And so the Hong Kong people have not been under that system. And I think what they're really scared of is sort of a creeping Chinaism, because once you can do this, then the next law and the next law. And so it's really tough on them.
Now, let's face it, it's a dictatorship. That's what this is really all about. You know, you have a dictatorship. You want to dictate. Now, Hong Kong has tremendous advantages for the Chinese. It's where the American businesses and everybody else's are. And, you know, clearly this is a place that becomes a center for people who want to trade with China. So on the one hand, they have this advantage. And on the other, the last thing they want is close by democratization of a system that threatens dictatorship. We all know that.
Yeah, and the quality of life that Hong Kong has enjoyed, I think, is something also that I think was viewed as benefiting potential changes to the mainland Chinese, and I think we're starting to see the reverse, that sure, that, you know, once these civil liberties have been taken away, it's going to be impossible for the people of Hong Kong to be able to get those back. The point about the intertwining, though, of their economic policy and their homeland security policy is really interesting, and it really does smack of the whole tariff situation. And you know, while we're starting to confuse some of our, you know, some of our priorities and mechanisms to deal with both, and that's something that we should be watching here as well.
Yeah, I'm curious if this will also spur those people who have those special interests to actually step up, because if you look at the what's going on right now, it's mostly young people, your everyday citizens who are out there protesting, but you haven't actually heard so much from the business lobby and those folks. So I do wonder if that will urge them to be more outspoken, especially because in that position of power you have more leverage.
Yeah, at the same time, though, it was an interesting article last week about Tiananmen Square and how the central government has really been trying to whitewash the whole Tiananmen Square massacre. And, you know, this has all of the makings of another Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. And again,
absolutely right.
Yeah. And for my concern, though, is that we should be a moral authority that condemns that activity, mm-hmm, not promotes the dictatorship or the authoritarian regimes that we've seen from the current administration.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's something that is very worrisome. You're exactly right.
And another interesting thing in China was that after Tiananmen, so again, I have like former students who've gone and started companies there. And then so they created sort of a capitalist layer on top of the communist system. And now a lot of people are worried because, again, that was starting to crumble. But a lot of the support for the government came because people were becoming economically well off. So people who were moving, you know, people moving from countries to city have been actually rewarded in good ways. There's a middle class in China that didn't used to be there. But that, of course, comes with all the benefit that, you know, once people are upwardly mobile. So a lot of them felt the government helped them. So they've had a lot of support. But as this sort of more authoritarian stuff comes in, they're getting much more worried about democracy. And the exact people that they're you know, same thing happened here where you have sort of that vanishing middle class. People are moving up and down, and that would be something very dangerous there.
I'm very interested in the parallelism between what's going on in this country, we've mentioned it, and what's happening in China. Mm. I mean, Xi is a very bright guy. What he does is he's named himself dictator for life, basically, by being president for life. So he's made the changes. We have a president who refers, in this country, who refers to elections as being rigged. And we are worried that this is a preliminary to saying, no, no, they didn't really win because we have a rigged election here. I get a lot of mail. It's hard for me to believe, to be honest with you, but that he's getting set up to never leave and that he's doing that. So if you take each of these indices that the Chinese are doing and you say, okay, is there any hint of the same thing in this country, I think it gets a little scary.
It absolutely gets scary, particularly when you think of the warmth of the relationship between China and Russia right now. And if you think about the questions that we've raised about our own country sort of being the moral compass, what stops Xi and the central government of China from moving in there? And if you start to look at what's been happening, it's hitting the people who are owning bookstores, mm-hmm. who are in the press, anyone who's a free speech advocate, and there are similarities here. I'm not accusing the current administration of being a central government like China, but these are, when you look at the steps that they are taking to remove the civil liberties from Hong Kong, we have got to watch very carefully because same as China, our civil liberties are lost. We will not get them back.
A couple of things that are interesting about that, and that is you can take a look at some of the things in this country, the gerrymander, for example. It's hardly democratic. The census question as to whether you want to include everybody who lives here or you want to scare them off. These are pretty dangerous hints as to what these folks have in mind for us.
They do. You're talking about manipulation of systems that the democracy depends on trusting, and people need to trust the election system to be fair, so that they can trust the results. They need to trust the justice system, that it is justice for all, and regardless of who you are, you're going to be treated fairly and equally. And every time we chip away at one of these institutions, we're weakening the foundation of our democracy. Mm-hmm. And that's the lesson that folks who are looking at Hong Kong really need to take into consideration, is that what does that mean for our own nation?
And I think the breaking down of the separation of what, so again, one of the things the U.S. has always prided itself on is a Justice Department that, even though it was part of the executive, was considered to be fair, separate. I mean, look at the stories on Barr today. I assume we'll talk about those later. But I don't want to give you this. Okay, you're in contempt. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to get the president to back me with executive.
I'm going to get the Supreme Court, in our pocket, right. Mm-hmm. to rule much. In our favor.
Right, chipping away. Well, actually, that's increasingly speeding up now.
Okay, so I admit it. I was watching Morning Joe this morning. And they had a guy on, an eminent historian, who says the people who say that this is the worst time in this country are wrong. This guy was saying, and I'm saying, no, I think the potential for evil here is the greatest we have ever seen in this country, because if you take the trajectory of the way that Trump is talking and what he wants to do in this country, at least we were able to get around some of the former things. There was the Civil War. There were things that happened in this country. Nevertheless, I think when you listen to what Trump is saying, it's more dangerous than anything we've ever seen.
Well, going back to the idea of civil liberties, I mean, that's what makes it so dangerous right now, is that there's so much more at stake. There was so much that was built upon by, previous policies and measures to protect people, and all of those are being undermined right now in the courts, in rhetoric, in what lies ahead for this election, and in again the institutions that were built to be the most reliable again have become politicized and polarized.
And one of the things that you're so right about here is that these judges that Trump has been picking have been largely approved by the Federalist Society. Think about the word Federalist. You know, these are the people who wrote the Constitution, who understood the difference between divided government and state and federal government. And yet, the very people who are undermining what we have are the people who are so-called the Federalists.
Yeah, the other interesting part about your comment, though, is that I don't want my kids to have to live in the worst time in history. I mean, we should be working towards creating the best time in history, and that's not what's happening right now.
Right.
So where do we think this is going to go over the next couple of days?
Well, what will happen will be that you know there'll be citations by the House holding people in contempt for not coming forward, Joe, and as a result of that, it's going to end up in the courts, and it'll end up in the biggest court of all, which is the handpicked court. I know you guys are laughing. Did I say something stupid?
No, we just thought we were talking Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So unfortunately, my prediction is what you're going to see is a stronger and stronger reaction by the authorities who are pretty much under the control of China.
They're going to stop people. Another way to say
whether it'll be a Tiananmen or whether it'll just be back off, and then it'll be buried.
They'll stop using rubber bullets, too. And that's what happened in Tiananmen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think you need to watch that.
And use regular bullets, I
mean. Midnight to 2 o'clock in the morning hour.
Mm-hmm.
When
the tanks roll in.
Because I think the government cannot, an authoritarian government cannot appear to be weak.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the two sides are backing each other into corners. And unfortunately, I think the protesters don't have the guns and the tanks that the government has.
But when you have a million people, and that's what, you know, there have been all kinds of estimates, the police say, 250,000. Other people have said 1 million people out there. That's a lot of people.
Well, and I think in this case, the only thing that's going through the people, too, is modern times and modern technology. I mean, we're in, like we saw with Arab Spring, if you document what's happening, and, you know, it's tough because of the region they're in, but I think that there are channels that at least information can be a little bit more freer, and I think the more that other groups are really watchdogging this issue, and maybe if they speak up to put some more pressure, it might not change things dramatically, but it can make it tougher for history to repeat itself.
Yeah, and anyway. you can push it underground, but I mean, to quote the Queen of Hearts, off with their heads. And you don't have to kill 1 million people, you only have to kill a few to make everybody say, whoa, you know, this isn't where I want to be. And once you take people off the streets, it's really easy to start to pick off folks.
Right. Mm. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters and we'll go on to other topics as well. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Bob Griffin, and Jen Smith join us this morning. We welcome you. We'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Alan Chartok and Jim Hendler, Bob Griffin, and Jen Smith. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I'm just handing Alan the letters. We'll go there, and then we'll move on to Biden and Trump in Iowa.
Eric says, our friend Eric says, Hong Kong. Good morning, panel. In the Hong Kong situation, I think we found the reason why protecting the integrity of our own legal system is so important. Mm-hmm. As China spreads its influence across the globe to challenge American economic hegemony, it will also challenge Western values of liberal democracy. We have the high ground. Only if we act to preserve freedom and justice at home, no one will trust us otherwise, just like Hong Kongers don't trust China. And that's from Eric in Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amen. Good points.
Thank you, Richmond.
Bright guy. Okay, Julius, another frequent writer, writes us, the surveillance state. Dear panel, the hype surrounding the fifth generation 5G telecommunications rollout promises instant communications and internet access for all, but also empowers unprecedented and unregulated surveillance of all. The increasing use of all, no. The increasing use of AI, artificial intelligence, we try not to use abbreviations here in our letters, but okay, AI, by unregulated businesses and the federal government makes profiling such as Chinese social credit system inevitable. Beware the Trojan horse of technology. Julius.
So Boy, let me comment.
I was going to say,
take it away, Jim.
Well, no, I mean, I think he was
put that on a platter.
I think
for
he
you.
Was. I think he was listening in during break, yes. Because we were actually talking about that among the panelists. So one technology by itself really is neutral. You can use it for good. You can use it for bad. Ethics is what really governs that. And one of the things we're seeing is the current government is very, very anti-regulatory. But even the past couple governments have really been pretty much against regulating business. And what that does is it lets things that China does at a national level, those same technologies are now starting to be deployed by local police departments, by states, cities. So again, one of the problems is you get this kind of creeping in, and we don't have a federal system at the moment that wants to weigh in on, let alone Russian interference. I mean, McConnell won't let the election interference laws hit the floor. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of a crazy situation because we have stuff where we can see where it goes, right? We have a police department says, well, you know, the fact that we're tracking stuff in our town and now people are getting arrested, isn't that a good thing? You just got to extrapolate it out and say, where are the boundaries? And that's always been a job of states and federal governments that are, to a very large degree, refusing to get involved in this stuff. So I think the letter writer is absolutely correct that the technology side of things is going to require technologists getting much more involved in ethics and policy than we've been for a long time.
Well, and who, you know, it's not only just, you know, where are the boundaries, but who's going to enforce them and uphold them?
And as you use more and more technology, understand that you're trading convenience for privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely. Go into it with your eyes wide open and understand that all of the convenience that you enjoy comes with a price, and you get a balance. That.
Too late.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is we now have facial recognition, for example, and you can now pick the crook out of the crowd by using it, and that's the justification for it. But of course, there are some negative aspects to all of this also.
Mm-hmm. And it's not a fail-safe either. I mean, I think a lot of that's not entirely correct. I mean, I was traveling this year, and through facial recognition technology got pulled into customs, and they mixed me up with someone who happened to have the same birth date but a completely different gender and ethnicity.
Not the same face.
No. So the system is flawed.
So I'm actually teaching a course this summer called AI in Fiction and Fact, and what I'm really going to try to do is get the students to understand the difference between what they're reading in the papers, what's really happening, what they think the technology can do, what the technology can actually do. And I think it's absolutely incumbent on me and my colleagues to start, to start figuring out exactly what this stuff, where the boundaries are. And, you know, I'm very involved. I sit on a lot of advisory committees for government and stuff. And I'm trying to get that same message there, because until people understand it's just a technology and it's how we use it that matters. Mm-hmm. And understanding when it's right and when it's wrong and what the weaknesses are is really crucial.
That's a big mistake. You're supposed to say, what's a big mistake?
What's a big mistake?
I was just looking over to see what's a big mistake.
Teaching summer school. Horrible.
Just putting that out there.
6-week class, four days a week. I don't see what the problem is summer.
Right.
But,
And for those of you that are agreeing with Alan's position, you're almost done. It's only a couple more weeks left in the term.
First term. I'm in the
Hang in there.
I've done it, and I don't like it.
All right. So did you have another letter there, Alan, or is that
Oh, please, Joe.
Yeah,
Thank you very much. Appreciate that prodding. Steve in Cooperstown, it says, I was staying in Hong Kong for a conference on June 4th, 89, the day of the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Wow.
Early that morning, we took a bus from Hong Kong into southern mainland China without any knowledge of the events in Beijing, more than 1,000 miles to the north. Nevertheless, we witnessed block streets and people marching with signs written in Chinese. Our bus driver had a worried look on his face and turned the bus around to return to Hong Kong. It wasn't until later that day we were safely back in our hotel rooms watching CNN that we learned what we saw. I wonder what happened to the people outside Beijing that were never mentioned during remembrance of Tiananmen Square. Hmm. And that's from Steve in Cooperstown.
Yeah, no,
Steve, so did Cooper asked it down.
It's a really good question, and I don't think that we have full insight into what the Chinese regime has done to its own citizens.
Mm. Sure.
And the number of their citizens that are in, you know, quote, re-education, unquote, facilities. Although, you know, there's more and more information coming out, particularly about the Western border and what's happening with the Muslim community in mm-hmm. China. But I don't think after Tiananmen Square we really appreciate the level of crackdown that went on across the nation.
And that it just had such a lasting impact and that it's not completely gone away.
So, but I think part of understanding this, and this took me going to China a number of times and talking to people, is that the government came in with a carrot and a stick, right? So they came in with, you know, punishing and imprisoning people and things like that. At the same time, they said the right way to solve this problem is make people have more money, build a better social system. So the previous president there really, I mean, although he was still an authoritarian and still looking at the communist system, cleaned up a lot of corruption, built an economy, you know, helped people build an economy, made huge investments in research and things like that to try to turn China into a leading nation, which it now is. But that sort of caused the people in the country to get, you know, sort of fat and happy and say, well, so a few people are in jail, I'm making money.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a very clever strategy. The new government is much less concerned. They're really much more willing to clamp down. And a lot of my Chinese colleagues are very nervous about what the future looks like there.
And it was reaction to the previous. That's what happens. Okay, another letter. And this comes from Ali. Do we really think it's Trump creating policy? Clearly, no. So who is? Stephen Miller and Jared Kushner? Your thoughts, please. Who goes first?
So I'll take that. I mean, the president is always the tip of a much larger iceberg and is responsible for the policies of their administration.
Absolutely.
But the letter writer is correct that it is the people in the administration that he has surrounded himself with that are setting policy.
But that's your point. The point is
absolutely.
He's the guy who chose them. Therefore, he's responsible.
And that's the buck stops here mentality that you don't see right now with this current administration. The comment about who's setting policy, it's a little terrifying when you look at a Stephen Miller in his okay. background and setting immigration policy where frankly in other administrations he wouldn't have even gotten a position in the administration. And I would say that's in both Democrat and Republican administrations.
Yeah. Well, that's right. You can't separate those people from the people who put them there. And believe me, if they were saying things that this president didn't like, they wouldn't be there.
And no, he's quick to pull the trigger on people that that he thinks disagree with him. And this is everywhere. I mean, if you think about the, you know, what's happening in health and human services, if you think of what's happening in HUD, you know, his choice of cabinet appointees. And more importantly, it's not just the secretary. It's at the lower levels of the political appointees where they have brought people in that I think are absolutely inept and would never have been in these positions of authority in any other administration.
So, you know, just to give you an example, the gentleman on my right, for those of you who can't see us, it's, Mr. Griffin here, Dr. Griffin, was working for DHS. The position that he filled has been filled by someone who is not even an acting. It's what's called a senior officer performing the duties. But the key point about that is it's a way you put someone in charge for a long period of time without needing congressional approval. If you actually look at the number of unfilled seats that require congressional approval, it's huge. It's bigger than any administration of the past 30. There was just a thing showing that. So Obama was accused of having very few people with, you know, I think there were 100-something seats unfilled. And in his case, it was mostly because the Republicans wouldn't put through the nominees. Mm. With Trump, it's about three times as much. And it's because they're not putting the people up, because they know even the Republicans don't like some of these guys. So they're just simply
keeping
ignoring
it.
And in fact, this is where McConnell has sold the power of Congress right down the river, is that ability to advise and consent that the Senate has over political appointees is that check and balance that we see is so far out of balance right now.
Yeah, if he deserves, if Trump deserves to be impeached for anything, it's for destroying the Constitution and the norms embodied in the Constitution. But that ain't what they're going to get him on.
No, and he's got a lot of people who are going happily down the creek with him. You know, and you put McConnell in that boat, and you put Lindsey Graham in that boat, and certainly some of the cabinet positions.
All of those you've just mentioned have appeared from time to time on my top three.
So can I add Pence to our discussion of people who are pulling strings behind the scenes? So what I find interesting is he stayed very much out of. The minute he gets in the news, he gets yelled at by Trump. So he's learned. But it seems to me, and I've heard rumors of this from people in D.C., that he is pulling a lot of the congressional strings.
When it comes to policymaking, especially.
Yeah, not McConnell and Graham, who are, you know, protecting Trump, but in terms of moving particular legislation, a lot of the judicial appointments went through him and were signed off on by Trump, but Trump couldn't care about anyone below the Supreme Court. Pence cares about everyone.
Well, of course, he has good reason to. He's scared to death that the president won't bring him along the next time when he runs. Although I have to say this, as of this morning, I'm a pretty happy guy, because if you take a look at these polls, they are death for, and I mean that politically, for the president, including all of the states he won in. He's underwater, seriously. And the one that got me this morning was Texas.
So
if he's underwater in Texas, if the president's underwater in Texas, forget about him, because he probably will win Texas. But what if Beto drops out, which he should, and then runs for Senate there? They could win that seat.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, it's time for the Democratic the presidential.
So let's. Why don't you hold that?
Sure.
Let's take a break, come back, and then we'll get into all of these numbers, because there's a whole lot of numbers coming out, and then the fighting between Trump and Biden and all that good stuff. So let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll get into that. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for this morning. Let me go to some other subjects, and we'll talk about other stuff. Just as we were going into the break, we started to talk about politics. So let us begin with Joe Biden and Donald Trump exchanging fire in Iowa, ignoring all the others in the field, but they ridiculed one another in the harshest terms they've used so far, significantly escalating a feud that loomed over not only their dueling visits to Iowa, but of course, the 2020 presidential contest more broadly. Biden questioned the president's intelligence, challenged his morals. By turns chiding and goading, Biden, whose speeches can sometimes ramble and meander, offered one of his most coherent rationales for seeking the presidency. I'm all for coherency. The president is literally an existential threat to America, Biden said in Ottumwa, Iowa, the first of several events in which he delivered a multi-pronged indictment of Trump's policies, values, and character. Trump, who has repeatedly brushed aside the advice of aides who warn against elevating Biden by attacking him, responded with the plain-spoken vitriol that built his political brand. He pointed to Biden's dismal finish in the 2008 presidential campaign, saying Barack Obama took him off the trash heap by making Biden his running mate, and suggesting the former vice president has lost a step. He's a different guy, Trump said as he left the White House. He looks different than he used to. He acts different than he used to. He's even slower than he used to be. Biden is 76. Trump is 73 on Friday, making both significantly older than most of the Democratic field. And then Trump, having to wrap all of that up, said Joe Biden is a dummy. And here we go. We're off to the races.
I think that deserves
a
time
Friday
out.
Friday is Trump's birthday, and it's not a national holiday?
I know.
Stop. Don't encourage.
Let's not put ideas.
Banks and post offices are open on Friday.
So I was laughing at this story because when I read it, it sort of, in my mind, summarized the difference between where the Democrats and Republicans are right now. The Democrats use a term of an existential crisis, which I'm not sure people really understand what the heck that is. And the Republicans just call him a dummy, and coming from a trash heap, which sort of people sort of respond to. It part of me says that this is absolutely shameful about where we are in American politics. I would like the Democrats, particularly Biden, to take the high road. Now that he's in Iowa, I would remind him of the story that wrestling with a pig in the mud only gets you muddy, and you realize that the pig enjoys it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this is the state of American politics, and I think in order to win nomination, whoever on the Democratic side is going to have to show that they can go toe-to-toe with the president. Right. But they are playing to this man's strength.
Although, you know, they're hidden deep in that story is the fact that Biden is actually scoring some points in Iowa. So Iowa has just had the worst flooding in their history, and, you know, Biden mm-hmm. is sitting there saying, and, you know, this is Trump's climate change policy is ignore it. And you're seeing what happens. And then Affordable Care Act, they're one of the states that's been very hard hit. So, you know, Iowa's going to be an interesting place to start. It's always weird that Iowa starts. And when you the more you look into how the caucuses run, the less.
Okay, so if you
were... But I think who comes out of there is going to have some momentum. And it wasn't looking good for Biden, but now it's really
I think it's looking extremely good for Biden.
Now it is, I think, yeah.
And the reason I think so is that he's not Trump. You know, he's considered. He's nice. He raises the discourse. He slams them all right, but he does it in an intellectual fashion, which is acceptable as opposed to calling him dirty names. And I think that while people were enamored with the Trump approach of calling names and everything in the beginning, they are not anymore. They're embarrassed by it. And I think it's changing. I think it's changing before our very eyes. I think Biden is smart. He's taking advantage of it. I agree with Trump about one thing. He doesn't look that great. I mean, he has a sort of laconic sort of pallor. That's a mixed metaphor, I'm sure, that is not particularly vigorous.
I think just the whole context of the story is slightly gruesome for the just American understanding of voting choices that, you know, we condemn this, especially in national media, but at the same time, it's taking the top place in front of consumers, especially on network news, which is where, you know, a lot of the eyeballs are. But I think, you know, what Jim had mentioned, that Biden did in his talks bring up some issues. Will he actually carry those issues forth and make salient points that can solidify his current state in the polls will be interesting to watch, and who else chimes in.
But so far, Jen, so far so good for him.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps doing extremely well in the polls.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's also
we've got
proven...
one letter here that says "Go Bernie, go."
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie's the one candidate who's beating Biden up.
Yeah, yes. Well, and then I think people are too. I think, you know, Biden was, for example, when he was questioned by reporters earlier in the day, he avoided the Hyde Amendment question, which he is accountable to. It's a definite issue.
Well, what do you want him to do?
He eventually did, but I think, you know, I think in this current climate of voters and voter action, that's something that can help or hurt someone's campaign,
too. It could, but I don't agree with you. I think his numbers are holding up. They're increasing, if anything. Mm-hmm. The Go Bernie, the thing that bothered me was this letter say, Go Bernie, go, because when somebody's that excited about Bernie, and I, of course, voted for him last time, I wasn't secret about it, mm-hmm. but a lot of people didn't vote for Hillary who were Bernie supporters. That could get you Trump back in. Mm-hmm. And I really shake my head.
And Bernie's speech could change a lot of things today, you know, depending on, you know, how he addresses his own right. style of politics. And
he ain't going to
win. Part of what scares me is where, you know, we're doing the Democratic thing of eating our own, right? Mm-hmm. Again, everything Biden has done wrong, we discuss. Mm-hmm. Everything Trump has done wrong, the Republicans sweep under the table mm-hmm. and say, that's just Trump, move on,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't know that it would be better if we were ignoring these things, but I think we have to be very careful about the fact that this is a PR game and our candidate, we got to rally behind him if you're a Democrat, and, you know, do it. Now, again, I'm not endorsing anyone, but in fact, I'm not sure who I would endorse if I could.
Well, I think that's a problem with the Democrats to begin with, right, too, right now.
Yeah. So yesterday the news cycle was on Biden versus Trump, and there are 23 other Democrats mm-hmm. who are barnstorming the state of Iowa trying to be heard? And at what point do I assume the debates that are starting will help? And we see numbers that there is a grouping of these candidates.
I don't know why it's going to help so much. I'll tell you, you know, CNN and MSNBC, I mentioned this yesterday, have had tremendous visibility of these candidates. They have special town meetings. They put them on. Nothing's moved. So you wonder if this isn't set. I think most of the middle-class Americans that I talk to, you know, just want somebody who can beat Trump. And that this is extremely important, and they see Biden as that guy, and it shows up in the polls. However, if you were to take Elizabeth Warren's numbers and Bernie's numbers mm-hmm. and add them together, then you got somebody who's beating Biden.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know the other part of the Iowa story that I think is interesting to watch is sort of this basic question. You know, that there's an assumption that the economy is doing wonderful. And the question I have is, I think Iowa may be telling us that most people don't feel that it's doing wonderful for them, that the stock market and the tax break for the wealthy 1% is not trickling down, and people are onto it, which could be a real problem for the Republicans in this next election.
Yeah, but on the other hand, would you rather have a robust economy with all of these signs to run with, which is why I think he's got a good shot. Trump's got a good shot. Would you rather have? I mean, you can say that a lot of Americans aren't feeling the prosperity, but you got full employment, basically full employment, and you've got a healthy stock market, and you say, okay, if you're Trump, you're a very happy man.
Yeah, but you've got masked employment, right? I mean, the wages haven't kept up.
Exactly.
Benefits are down for most of the folks that I think are sort of in the middle. They're more threatened than they've ever been, and the trumpeting about the success of the economy is frankly it's a success for very few, mm-hmm. and it's not success when you've got to work three jobs. In order to make ends meet, and your benefits are gone.
It is fair to say that you know the stock market is giving people a sense of stability right now because it's not, you know, performance earlier this year has been very volatile. And then if you ask anyone who has a 401k who's been watching, they're essentially losing money in a lot of ways.
Stable is not the word that comes to mind.
So if you guys were, you know, if Obama was the president right now and we were doing this well, would you be saying the same things you're saying now?
I don't know. If the facts were there that you know the market still wasn't doing well and there was still a gap in wages versus employment, I think people would still be.
Here's the way I see this panel, and I certainly agree with what you're saying. But you are a bunch of intellectuals, you know, you say you have to look at this and look at that. Most people don't get beyond sort of the basic face figures, and I think that's what this is about.
Yeah, and Alan, that's the problem I have with using terms like the existential crisis, because that's not the language that normal people use during the course of their the course of their daily lives. But they get dummy and trash heap.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we've got letters, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. First, Redgraph with news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock, Jen Smith, Robert Griffin, Jim Hendler, and Alan Chartok, who has some letters. We'll go there.
Mark in Saratoga. There were a few errors in the panel discussion on Hong Kong. One, there will be no tanks or bullets. What is likely to happen is the legislature will eventually debate and pass the bill. But if Carrie Lam is removed from office afterwards, the protesters won. China did learn from Tiananmen. Two, there was no survey evidence that supports the idea that middle-class Chinese support democracy. Three, Hong Kong businesses will not support the demonstrators. To understand Hong Kong, you need to understand the institutions of their semi-democracy and Hong Kong identity.
So just
wait, sorry. One last sentence. The panel applied a distinct American liberal bias, which differs from reality on the ground in Greater China. Go.
Sorry, I just wanted to make it clear that I was actually saying the middle class in China supported the government. The middle class was created largely out of a reaction to Tiananmen to have a supportive group. Mm-hmm. And so, again, if I was implying that the middle class was pro-democracy in China proper, that's not so much true. What they are starting to chafe at is some of the major autocratic moves. So people who are starting companies now and are in the capitalist system are suddenly being told, you can't do this, you can do this. We're backing this company, not that company. And that's starting to play out. But again, they're still pretty much supportive of the government. Domestically, they're very worried about international policy, again, because business is now international. So I think it's I think the writer is right that we were looking at it from a particular view. But I think they're wrong in the sense that I think things in China this year. So last time I visited, I felt more. You heard more discussion again. And I'm talking, you know, about the intelligentsia, but they're often involved in these things. Much more concern than I did 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I would say they were by and large very, very pro-government. Now I'm hearing rumbling. So again, I think it's just a complicated system. He's also might be very well correct about the no tanks and bullets, because what they'll do is economics.
I think they're going to – I take a different view. I think there's a very good chance you will see tanks and bullets. And if you say they learned from what happened in Tiananmen, I think what they learned is they can continue to control things by doing that.
Yeah, and it's an excellent letter, though, and you know, I hope he's correct about the bullets and tanks. But there are plausible scenarios, particularly with the issues that they're having in their western provinces, that you could lead to the idea that there's going to have to be some additional crackdown beyond economic, simply because they can only allow so much unrest.
And you know what? Rubber bullets almost always precede real bullets.
Right. Yeah. That one I think you will see.
Yeah. And and even the water cannons. I mean, these are not. These are not, you know, a gentle
processes. Sure, you can die from water cannon.
Absolutely, you can. The problem, the concern that I have is, you know, I think the Chinese central government has done a wonderful job in insulating themselves. They've worked an agreement with Russia. They've pretty much been able to discount America as sort of a moral counterweight to what's going on. And frankly, I think there is a freer hand for the hawks in the central government to show the rest of the population that they are as strong or stronger than they've been in the past. That's where I'm really concerned.
Mm-hmm. And
other than that, I think that the letter was really well written, and thank you for participating.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the difference, though, is I think it's significant of who the protesters were, even though they did eventually get chased away. And that shows like the difference between generational thought that's being expressed. Again, it was the
Tiananmen was generational.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
And,
right.
You know, I think also when it comes to how the government will control the situation, I one of the things that worried me when I heard the reports is that among the fatalities was a really well-known radio journalist this morning. And so, that was it just a matter of him being there? Was it directed? We don't know. But, you know, I think that's just not being able to hear, fairly what's going on is going to be a challenge. But I think the writer again is right that they are grappling with these issues as a semi-democracy, not a full democracy.
Who's the semi-democracy?
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Oh, Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
But not China.
Not China.
No. And China thinks they own Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, they want their way with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Although, for us to understand the situation there is very difficult. So, for example, when I'm in China, I can go to Hong Kong just by taking a subway, right? Yeah. You need a visa if you're a Chinese citizen to go to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. The way to get the subway, 96th Street?
Shenzhen.
So anyway.
Alan, before you read the next letter, can I just give a shout-out to the letter writer? What I love about the roundtable is when we get letters like that, not just that you agree with what we're saying, but you're really thoughtful and it's a well-written letter, and it really
agreed.
Expands the dialogue we're having. So thank you to whoever wrote that letter.
And that was Mark in Saratoga.
Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Democracy in action.
Cheers to you, Mark. Okay. So Sean says, can the Dems ever trust polls again after the 2016 election? CNN, the day before the election, had a one had a 1.96% chance of Trump winning the presidential election. Thanks, love the show, Sean from Cambridge. Well, I don't want to blow my own horn, but I called it. So what else can I tell you? Polls are polls.
So,
what?
Yeah, you know, I think part of what's happened in several of the past elections is what we've seen is more the limits of polling technique than polls per se. Because, again, what elected Trump was people not voting for Hillary. Right. And that you can't poll for non-voting very well. You go to likely voters and you say, who are you likely to vote for? You don't have a lot of people who answer by saying, I think I'm going to stay home.
But can you how do you get around questions that answers that you wouldn't tell your mother? I mean, that's the one that's always gotten me. You know, if you're a racist, if you're a misogynist, if you're one of those folks, you're not about to say, I'm voting for this guy. You step in there and some devil on your shoulder says, do this.
So the predicted numbers for Trump were actually pretty accurate. What was wrong was the predicted numbers for Hillary in the key states.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, again, that may have been people who voted for Trump saying, I'm going to vote for Hillary because they were embarrassed. But we didn't see a lot of that. What we saw is a lot of people saying, I'm going to vote Democrat or I'm going to vote for Hillary, and then that number didn't hold. So
I get it. I get the results. I do get the results.
So again, I think what's going to make the difference in the next election, whichever side you're on, go out and vote.
What are the same angry people who voted, who didn't want to vote for Hillary, are going to be angry for the same reason with Joe Biden? And I would make the case they are not.
The other thing too about the story, the story about the poll numbers that has come out is the Times article that came out yesterday, which indicated that the internal polling that Trump's campaign is doing is equally abysmal, and he is telling all of his aides just to ignore it and to lie about it.
And you know, I actually would have done the same thing if I was Trump. I don't trust any of the polling right now. I'm not sure that we know how to capture the whims and positions of our current society. I really don't. And time after time, I think our polls and our polling are getting less scientific and less correct. So I'm looking at everything with a very jaded eye.
So Joe, let's get a pollster on the round table soon if we can. That'd be great.
Beat him up.
But I would throw out that, you know, polls at this point are pretty meaningless anyway. I think what we're really going to need to see is what happens. So you had Iowa, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and then the South. Mm-hmm. Right. So first of all, none of those three are Biden's strongest places.
Recently there's a recent poll in New Hampshire which was quite positive.
That's what
for
I was
going
to say. So yes. If he comes out of those strong, that's going to send a very strong message because, again, that's not his natural constituency. Mm-hmm. Right.
And remember,
then now,
New
if
Hampshire,
he comes out of that week and someone else comes out as the lead, that's going to turn it into a much more complex story. So I think trying to even guess at this point.
But, let's remember that New Hampshire is hardly the liberal bastion of all times. Until recently, their only major newspaper was probably the most conservative in the nation.
Yeah.
And I think Biden appeals to an awful lot of people in the middle.
Yeah, it's whether he can get enough traction. I think then California becomes really, really critical, and that may be the tipping point this year.
Sure.
I mean, Jim made a comment about, you know, the oversized influence that Iowa plays in American politics. It really is bizarre to me that, you know, you think about Iowa and New Hampshire sort of driving, our national politics the way they are. I mean, that's the way it's been.
Well, back to the letters. Jeannie says it's so early in the process that not even a single debate. Don't coronate Biden. There's a year and a half to go. We get the horse race coverage everywhere else. Please talk about their policies and what they've done. Please. And that's from Jeannie.
Yeah, I agree that we should definitely be talking about those policies more. But, I think it is also premature because we don't know who's actually going to be able to go out to the actual voting booths and we don't know who's being included in the poll samples. We don't, and And I think people's positions will change because of circumstance, because,
Things happen, yeah.
I think, you know, the rhetoric of what's being said about different issues can really change a voter's stance. You know, if someone makes a certain promise to agriculture or labor, then you're going to have different outcome in the next, you know, coming year.
And Jeannie, you're right, but polls are sort of like that bruise on your arm. You just can't help but poke it every once in a while.
Good analogy.
And Daisy writes, Alan, he is not doing well in the polls. Stop. All the leading pollsters, including in Iowa, are saying his numbers are soft. When they ask people if are enthusiastic about choosing Biden, the numbers are very soft. Those are numbers to look at. Numbers are high for Warren and Buttigieg and Harris. It is early. Let's have some debates. Mark my words, Biden will not be the nominee, says Daisy.
I think Daisy's wrong, but thank you
So do I. but thank you for your letter. Anyway, Kevin says, Alan, I normally agree with you, but I have to disagree today. Normally, I would be thrilled with the Democrats' poll numbers against Trump, but the 2016 election tainted those numbers. I won't believe the numbers again until they are right. Kevin from Melrose, 55300. Okay. John writes, final thoughts. Mueller had no case, pardon me, and it's too pompous to admit defeat. So he clouded the presumption of innocence for a political second bite at the apple. Now we have the most current claim. Mueller couldn't prove that Trump isn't guilty of obstructing an investigation into a crime that he didn't commit. The Mueller probe was the second biggest fraud in American history. Right after the collusion hoax. There it is. Right after the collusion hoax. Mueller used corrupted informants, doctored transcripts, and hid exculpatory information to try to paint a false narrative about Trump. Incumbent career politicians are complicit in this embarrassment. Best. What do you mean best? John in Albany.
So, John, I actually disagree with you on most of your premises. I think if I would urge you to go back and reread the Mueller report or read it, yeah. Particularly some of the annex, I think there
you
is.
You mean Republican Mueller?
Yes.
Republican Mueller, who was who was at the top of everybody's list of being a fairly good guy, or FBI guy.
Yeah, with 11 pretty concrete examples of potential obstruction that only Congress can act on. I do believe that there is more behind the Mueller report.
Paul writes, good morning. I'm from Canada, and I've been traveling in the U.S. For business for 30 years. This is the worst crisis ever to hit you guys, with the Republican Party ready to abandon any pretense at democracy under the leadership of Mitch McConnell, whose motto is probably, quote, the end justifies the means, even if it means backing up the most ridiculous human being ever to be elected to office in history of modern USA. You should be worried. And that comes from Paul. And Marilyn says, letters. People keep talking about finding a smoking gun. What we have with this administration is a slow-burning lit fuse. If we cannot stand up and hold this administration accountable, we will never, in capital letters, be able to hold a future administration accountable. Lawlessness in broad daylight. Undermining of norms and values is now commonplace. Justice for all is not currently happening and hasn't been. We must take a long, hard look and ask ourselves, why aren't we in the streets by now? Self-interest rather than selfishness is becoming the American way. And then finally, Joe, last letter from Stephen, who writes, dear panel, have any group of World War II vets come forward to speak about the encroaching authoritarianism, fascism, that they fought so valiantly against? Their numbers are dwindling, and we should hear them now. After the U.S., what major country is left to speak for the values toward which we aspire? Thank you. So according to Stephen, there are no other societies. Well, I think Macron is one guy. I think the chancellor in Germany is another person. So I don't think we're unique here.
No. I think it's faulty to think that that we are unique. We certainly are great, have been great, and will be great again. But that doesn't mean other people aren't great as well. But it also shows, I think, a weakness in our current positioning, our lack of what we've done to our long-term allies, what we've done to people's perception around the world of the United States as being a bastion of frankly, what is good in the world. And being a place that is full of hope and opportunity. And those aren't empty ideals. You know, when you start to think about your own families, you know, when they came to this country, what did they come with? And why did they come here? And what did they lay down for you in order to be successful today? And I think that gets lost in this whole conversation.
You know, I think there's another aspect of this, too. So, you know, Trump's way of getting what he wants. Look at the Mexico thing, right? We're going to put tariffs on Mexico. Mexico is forced to the table. Hey, Trump won. But, you know, it's winning by bullying, right? And part of the problem is no one likes the bully, right? The bully often gets their way for a while because they're the big kid with the big fists. But, you know, I feel like we've alienated a number of the people we will need in international politics. I think many of the people that Alan just mentioned are under fire locally because the sort of Trumpism populism is growing in their spaces and used to be the U.S. who helped bolster a lot of that. Now the U.S. bolster the Democratic side of that. Now the U.S. is not serving as either a role model or a fair partner and with our friends, let alone our enemies. And so actually they're doing better with our enemies. Let's not go there.
Well, you know, but we've empowered, we're empowering creeping authoritarianism.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
we're empowering the bad behavior of North Korea, of a resurgent authoritarianism in China that we spent a lot of time talking about a manipulative Russian government, and these we were supposed to be our role is the counterbalance to those, mm-hmm. and right now I don't feel like we're acting that way, and we're leaving our allies with scratching their heads, wondering who they turn to in order to be able to combat those insidious effects of those authoritarian regimes. Mm-hmm.
We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Jen Smith, thank you. Bob Griffin, always good to have you here.
Thank you.
Jim, thank you. Same. Alan, thank you. Mm-hmm. We will continue and with the show, and of course we'll be back tomorrow with another panel. We welcome you to join that. We'll be right back.